In the session this evening, I want to come on to look at another topic which is related to the subject of the flood, the subject of the Ice Age. And we're going to see that Noah's flood actually helps us to explain the scientific evidence as it relates to what we know geologically about the Ice Age, which is the most recent geological event of extremely wide occurrence. The Ice Age was definitely something that really happened. Some people ask me, was there really an Ice Age? Well, the answer is yes. The evidence is very clear. There was a time when the climate over the Earth's northern hemisphere deteriorated and ice sheets extended over much of North America and Europe, including Britain. The question that I want to think about in the talk this evening is, how did the Ice Age happen? What caused the Ice Age? And what has Noah's flood got to do with it? So those are the questions that we're going to be thinking about. Now today, there are only two large ice sheets on the continents. They're found in Greenland and in Antarctica. But during the Ice Age, we know that the ice sheets were much more extensive. And this illustration here shows in white the maximum extent of the ice sheets during the Ice Age. Now, how do we know that the ice was once as extensive as this? Well, we know it because the ice has left its mark on the landscape that we see around us. There are many evidences of a former Ice Age. Many landforms that were produced by ice erosion can be observed in the mountainous regions of the north. I know that Ian has just come back from the Lake District, and the Lake District is one of the places where you can see evidence of ice erosion. Here are just some of the features that were formed by the ice. We have these features called corries. These are semicircular basins that you find near mountain peaks, and they were carved out where mountain glaciers were born. Ice formed in a hollow, and as the ice moved and perhaps rotated in that basin, it carved out this semicircular basin. And sometimes you find these basins back to back, and they form a very sharp and steep a ridge, like Striding Edge in Helvellyn. If you've ever walked Striding Edge, that's formed between two of these kinds of basins. We also have very distinctive U-shaped valleys. These are formed as the ice moves from the mountain peaks down slope under the influence of gravity. And as they go down slope and go into the valleys, they widen and deepen the valleys that are confining them. So we have these very distinctive U-shaped valleys as opposed to the V-shaped valleys that are generally formed by rivers. And then we also have evidence like these scratch marks here. This is a striated pavement. Ice, as it moves, picks up debris. It contains within it rocks and boulders and pebbles and so on. And as that material scrapes against the rock over which the ice is moving, it can polish it smooth in places. Sometimes it causes grooves and scratches, often in these parallel formations, which give you some clues as to which way the ice was moving. So we have evidence in the mountainous regions of the north. But we also have evidence of the ice in the more lowland regions where the southerly margins of the ice sheets were, for example, in East Anglia. These regions tended not to be areas of ice erosion, but areas where there was deposition of sediments by the ice sheets. And so we have them blanketed with glacial sediments. Much of this sediment laid down by the glaciers is in the form of glacial till. It's a kind of unsorted mixture of pebbles and boulders of various sizes and shapes set within a clay or a sand matrix, and it was deposited either directly when the ice sheets melted or by streams of meltwater that were issuing from the glaciers. We have hummocky ridges and mounds of till like these. They're called moraines, and they mark the place where the sides or the snout of a glacier once used to be, and they push this glacial sediment, this till, up into these ridges. And then we also find boulders like these. They're called glacial erratics. They're scattered boulders of rock, often sitting on bare bedrock, just where they were dumped by the melting ice sheets. And often they're different in composition to the rocks underneath, so we know that they've been moved. They've been moved from some distance away, and then they were dropped when the ice melted. So we have a great deal of evidence that there really was an ice age in the Earth's history. There's very little doubt that much of our present landscape owes its origin to the former existence of these ice sheets. However, trying to explain how an ice age actually got started is not at all easy. We need a very curious combination of circumstances to explain an ice age. We certainly need colder summers. We need a drop in temperature. That seems obvious for an ice age. You need a drop in temperature. Because an ice sheet will only grow, it will only accumulate where snow that is laid down in one winter survives through the summer until the next winter. Because you have to have the accumulation of snow year on year on year. So you must have the snow surviving through the summer months. It can't all melt, otherwise you'll never build up an ice sheet. So we do need a drop in temperatures on the northern continents to enable any snow that falls in the winter to survive. However, cooling alone is not sufficient. There are places today on the Earth where it's cold enough for an ice sheet, if one were to be kind of placed there, it could survive. The trouble is, it doesn't grow there today naturally because there isn't enough moisture in the atmosphere. You see, what we need also, in addition to colder temperatures, is we need higher rates of snowfall. We need more snow than falls today in the winter. And this is a real problem because these two requirements for an ice age actually run into one another. Because as you lower the temperature of the atmosphere, it actually reduces its ability to hold moisture. So generally, when the atmosphere is colder, it becomes drier. So we have a problem here in explaining how you can get an ice age started because you need this very unusual set of circumstances. Cold temperatures on the continents, but higher snowfall. And this unusual combination of circumstances, it's no good just having it for a year or two. This has got to happen for year upon year upon year, over a relatively long period of time. It's got to persist for some time in order that the snow builds up so that it can become compacted into an ice sheet. So this is effectively the ice age problem. And the magnitude of this ice age problem is often not appreciated, even by many scientists. The meteorologists who are working in this area to explain what happened during the ice age are well aware of many of these problems, but many other scientists are not aware of them. One attempt that was published in the literature to try to simulate the conditions that were needed to glaciate northeast Canada concluded that you needed at least 10 to 12 degrees centigrade summer cooling. So you had to lower the temperatures in the summer by a considerable amount, 10 to 12 degrees, and you needed twice the present amount of snowfall in order to generate an ice age. Now, in the last session, we thought about this principle of uniformitarianism that dominates the modern science of geology. This is the principle that the present is the key to the past, that we look at the kinds of processes that are going on around us in the world today, and we extrapolate them back into the past, and we use these processes to explain what happened in the Earth's past. There are serious problems with this principle, because when you try to apply it to an ice age, when we extrapolate back present conditions into the past, it simply doesn't give us the conditions that we need for an ice age. It's very difficult to see how an ice age could have been started on the northern continents under conditions that are anything like the conditions that we have in the world today. And in fact, this problem is multiplied many times over for conventional scientific reconstructions of Earth history, because conventional scientists believe in the fact that there was not just one ice age in the recent past. They believe that there was a succession of perhaps 50 ice ages during the last 2.6 million years. Now, we'll come on to that, because I want to argue that, in fact, the evidence strongly favours just one ice age. But the conventional view is that there have been a multiplicity of ice ages over a long period of time. And so this, for the conventional scientists, actually exacerbates this problem. If it's difficult enough to start one ice age, how do you start 50 ice ages in succession? Okay, so how did the ice age get started? How does Noah's flood, the event that we looked at last time, 2 weeks ago, how does that help us to explain how the ice age could have been initiated? And it really is the key, I believe, that helps us to unlock this particular mystery about the Earth's past. For those of you who were here 2 weeks ago, you'll remember that we looked at the biblical account of Noah's flood, and we noted that in Genesis chapter 7 and verse 11, the Bible gives us some very specific clues as to what happened to cause Noah's flood. The Bible says, in the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, the 17th day of the month, the same day were all the fountains of the great deep broken up and the windows of heaven opened. The Bible says that the primary cause of Noah's flood was the breaking up of the fountains of the great deep. And we looked at what those words mean. We looked at the Hebrew and what the original sort of language text, and we thought about what these words might mean. Fountains, it turns out, is the common Hebrew word that just means springs or fountains of water. And the Hebrew phrase great deep is a phrase that's used elsewhere in the Old Testament, and it refers to the ocean depths. So when we see this phrase, the fountains of the great deep, that seems to refer to some kind of fountains of water that are located in the ocean depths, in the deep ocean. And the Bible tells us that these fountains were broken up on a single day. The Hebrew word for broken up is interesting because it's a good geological word, it turns out. If you look at the Hebrew phrase, it's used elsewhere again in the Old Testament, and it's used to refer to geological activity. It's used to refer to faulting, to the cleaving of rocks. So we put all of this together, and we get a picture from the Bible that Noah's flood was essentially a tectonic catastrophe. It was a catastrophe that began in the oceans and that involved the breaking or the shattering of the Earth's crust and the release of fountains of water. And we spent a good deal of time in the last session just looking at what some geological clues we have to unlock what this passage is really speaking about. Now, during this catastrophic event of Noah's flood, we saw last time that there's strong evidence that the Earth's tectonic plates were rapidly rearranged. This was the theory that I referred to as catastrophic plate tectonics. Now, if you catastrophically rearrange the crustal plates of the Earth, and you replace, as we saw last time, the ocean floor, the old cold ocean floor, with relatively warm, hot new ocean floor in that recycling tectonic process, then one of the consequences of that is that you would add an enormous amount of heat to the oceans. Some of that heat may have been lost to space, even as the fountains of the great deep ballistically ejected water high up into the atmosphere. So some of that heat may well have been lost, but much of it must have been absorbed by the oceans themselves. And so the consequence is that by the end of this global flood, the oceans could have been anything as warm as anything up to about 30 degrees centigrade. There are obviously limits on how warm you can make the oceans without it being too deleterious to life. But we think that by the end of the flood, the oceans were somewhere around 25 to 30 degrees centigrade. And furthermore, because this was such a dramatic catastrophe with these seafloor upheavals going on and the rearrangement of the continents, the ocean waters must have become thoroughly mixed so that they would have been warm not only through their depth but also from pole to pole as well as from top to bottom. So that these waters were thoroughly stirred and were on the whole very much warmer than the ocean is today at the end of the flood. Now we have geological evidence, clear geological evidence that the oceans were in the relatively recent geological past much warmer than they are today. In the sediments that form on the ocean floor, we have tiny microscopic marine organisms. They're called foraminifera, or forams for short. You see some of them here. And scientists are able to analyse the ratio of different isotopes of oxygen that go to make up the shells of these creatures. And without getting into the technical details, basically the ratio of oxygen 18 to oxygen 16 in the shells of these creatures acts like a thermometer. Scientists can use that as a thermometer to deduce what the temperature was of the water at the time that these creatures were alive. And from this, they've been able to produce a curve of seawater temperature. Now, this is a curve plotted against the conventional timescale. Now, I don't accept the conventional timescale, as most of you know. And I think all of these events have happened in the much more recent past since Noah's flood. This timescale needs to be telescoped. But for now, let's just look at this graph over the conventional timescale, which is between 0 and 60 million years in the past. And here's temperature going from minus 5 up to about 20 degrees. And you can see that from these studies of foram shells, there's a clear decline in ocean temperature over time. So we know that in the past, the oceans were much warmer than the present day average, which is about 4 degrees centigrade. They were much warmer than that in the recent past and have gradually declined to the present temperature. Now, the warmth of the oceans immediately after the flood would have had a consequence, which is that the evaporation of seawater would have been much higher immediately after the flood than it is today. So there would have been a lot of seawater being evaporated into the atmosphere. All other things being equal, seawater evaporates 3 times faster at 30 degrees centigrade than it does at 10 degrees centigrade, and 7 times faster than at 0 degrees centigrade. So you can see that if you raise the temperature of the oceans to that kind of level, then you get much, much more evaporation of ocean water into the atmosphere. And as a result, the air over the oceans would have been absolutely jam-packed full of moisture. And as that moist air was circulated over the continents, it would have cooled and condensed, and it would have fallen as a very heavy and prolonged rain. The world immediately after Noah's flood, as a consequence of the heating up of the oceans and the evaporation from the oceans, would have been much, much wetter than the world is today. And this again helps us to explain some otherwise very puzzling geological evidence. For example, it helps us to explain why many of the regions of the world today that are very arid, the world's deserts, for example, they were once much, much wetter. In fact, scientists have been able to look at the subsurface using radar technology. They can look below the surface of the Sahara Desert, and below the sands of the Sahara, there's evidence of ancient river channels, some of them as large as the Nile River Valley in Egypt. So clearly, even in a place like the Sahara, it was once a very well-watered place. And geologists have been able to find fossils of animals that once lived there in the Sahara, and they include animals that live in or associated with the water. Animals like fish or crocodiles and hippos. There's evidence of human habitation in the Sahara on a much larger scale than we find today. And among the human artifacts that we find there, as well as these kinds of rock paintings, We find various tools and pottery, and we even find fish hooks and harpoons and things like that. So we know that this was a very much wetter place in the not so distant geological past. We know also that there were large lakes, some of which no longer exist today in many areas of the world. This is a map showing a former lake which no longer exists. It's been called Lake Manly. And there's evidence that this particular valley once held this lake that was 180 metres deep. Now, you'll be surprised when I tell you where that is. That's in California's Death Valley. Now, what do you know about Death Valley? Death Valley is, of course, extremely hot and dry today. And yet, in the past, it once contained a 180 metre deep lake, which has since dried up. And we know that even many lakes that still survive today, many modern lakes, were once much more extensive in the past. The Great Salt Lake in Utah was 17 times larger at its maximum extent than it is today. So these lakes have gradually dried up. They've gradually shrunk in size. So this is more confirming evidence that the world was indeed much wetter, as we'd expect from the aftermath of the flood. And indeed, it may have been the overfilling and then the catastrophic draining of two large lakes in the western United States that led to the rapid carving of the Grand Canyon. Now, many of you know that the Grand Canyon has been an area that I've particularly been interested in and have studied the geology of the canyon. And one of the things that many geologists are coming to conclude now is that the canyon was not carved by the slow and gradual erosion of the Colorado River over long periods of time. In fact, there's evidence that it was rapidly carved by the draining of these large lakes which existed to the east of the current Grand Canyon. If you fill in Grand Canyon, if you were able to kind of fill it in to the so that the canyon was no longer there, you'd actually find that to the east of the canyon there's this enormous saucer-shaped basin that could hold a vast volume of water. And indeed, there is evidence from lake sediments and fossils that there were once these large freshwater lakes or series of interconnected lakes here. And what it looks as though has happened is that at some point this high area here, the Kaibab Upwarp, has been breached in some dramatic way, and this water has catastrophically drained out. It's ended up in the Pacific Ocean, and on the way it carved out what we see today as Grand Canyon. So again, we have evidence of the western USA, this area of course being desert today, once being much, much wetter in the recent past. And that heavy rainfall after the flood must have resulted in massive erosion and sedimentation on a fantastic scale. And again, this helps to account for many otherwise enigmatic features of the Earth's surface. Consider, for example, the widespread erosion surfaces that you find actually on many continents of the world that are called peony plains. This is an aerial view showing the peony plain that exists in northern Arizona. So if you look north of Grand Canyon from the air, you can see this enormously widespread, flat surface of erosion. This is an erosion surface. Now, how do you explain such extensive and very flat erosion? Because it's unlike the kind of erosion that we see going on today. Erosion today tends to carve channels. It tends to carve gullies and gorges and ravines. To form such widespread flat erosion surfaces, what you need is very widespread runoff of water. Kind of sheet flooding is the kind of process that you have to invoke to explain these kinds of landforms. And we find many other strange landforms that seem to fit with this idea of a world that was once much wetter. Many of the streams and rivers in the world today are what we call underfit streams. What that means is that they're too small for the valley that they occupy. It looks as if at some time in the past that stream or river was much, much bigger to carve the kind of valley or canyon that it's in. We find very broad and flat wedges of sediment around the foot of mountain ranges. They're called pediments. And again, pediments are not being formed today. There's nowhere in the world where you can go to see these flat wedges of sediment being formed at the base of mountains. In fact, what's happening today is quite the converse. Those wedges of sediment are being dissected and eroded and cut into by streams and rivers. So they're actually being broken up and worn away. They're not being formed today. We have incredibly large, thick wedges of river-deposited material called alluvial fans. There are massive delta deposits around the mouths of major rivers. And all of this seems to point us to a time when those rivers were much larger and were depositing much larger quantities of sediment. So all of this fits this picture. So you have this wet world after the flood because of the warmth of the oceans. And it's these very unusual climatic conditions which set the scene for the onset of the Ice Age. As the oceans cooled by evaporation, the moisture in the atmosphere eventually began to fall in the mid and high latitudes, not as rain, but as snow. And in places where that snow was able to accumulate, there ice sheets would have begun to develop. Now, there were a number of factors that would have contributed to the accumulation of the snow. Remember, you've got to not only have high rates of snowfall, which is how, which is explained by the heat of the oceans, the amount of moisture going into the atmosphere, but we also need to have cooler temperatures to enable the snow that falls to survive the summers. And perhaps the most important factor that enabled the survival of the snowfall was volcanic activity. Now, volcanic activity was at its peak during Noah's flood. That was a volcanic and a tectonic catastrophe of the like of which the world has never seen before or since. But over time, after the flood, volcanic activity declined. And we see evidence of this when we look at the size and the scale of eruptions, for example, in Western North America. I'm sure many of you remember the eruption in 1980 of Mount St. Helens in Washington state. It hit the headlines around the world, a devastating eruption. But actually, on a historical scale, that eruption in 1980 was just a pinprick. It was just a tiny, tiny eruption compared to many in the past. The amount of ash that was deposited by Mount St. Helens is represented. This is the area over which the ash fell, represented by this red area. It amounts to that cube there, 1 cubic kilometre of ash. Okay, it was a devastating eruption, but that's how much ash was deposited by Mount St. Helens on May the 18th, 1980. However, when we go back in time, we find that there are much bigger eruptions. This one here, represented here by this yellow area, that's where we find the ash in the geological record, that is 75 cubic kilometres of ash. So much, much larger than Mount St. Helens. But the interesting thing is, as you go further back in time, the eruptions get larger. As you head back in time towards the flood, when volcanism was at its peak, we find that we have an increase in the scale of volcanic eruption. So here, this Huckleberry Ridge eruption, which was associated with Yellowstone, the eruption at Yellowstone National Park, very massive eruption. The amount of ash generated there is 2,500 cubic kilometres. I mean, it's just an entirely different magnitude than the kind of volcanism we have going on today. So we have this very energetic volcanism happening in the immediate post-flood period. And we know, for example, if we look at Ice Age sediments in North America, there are 68 individual layers of volcanic ash in the western USA alone. One exceptionally large Ice Age eruption, which took place in New Zealand, is estimated to have deposited a layer of ash over at least 10 million square kilometres of the South Pacific. So there were massive eruptions Now, why is this important in terms of preserving the snow? Well, volcanic eruptions inject vast amounts of dust into the atmosphere. You get vast amounts of volcanic aerosols and dust. And this material in the atmosphere has a cooling effect, very profound cooling effect. It causes more of the sun's radiation to be reflected back to space, and so it results in much cooler summers. Even some relatively small eruptions in historical times have led to some parts of the world almost going without a summer. For example, the 1783 eruptions in Iceland caused famine in many parts of the world because of the failure of harvests. And so we know that this has a very profound effect on atmospheric temperatures. Now, conventional scientists, they recognise, if you read the scientific literature, they will recognise that if you have a series of closely spaced volcanic eruptions, that would be sufficient in and of itself to begin to trigger the kind of lowering of temperatures that you need to start an ice age. So they recognise that this is a mechanism that you can appeal to start an ice age. However, the conventional scientists cannot appeal to this mechanism. And the reason is very simple. The conventional timescale is very long. They believe that these events have been spaced out over a period of many millions of years. So in their view, these volcanic eruptions are not very closely spaced together. They're very widely spaced out. So they can't appeal to this as a mechanism to cause the kind of cooling that we require for an ice age. However, the biblical timescale telescopes that timescale down to only maybe centuries, something like that. So instead of millions of years or hundreds of thousands of years, the biblical timescale regards all of these eruptions as having happened within a relatively short period after the flood. And we know that that would be sufficient to begin to initiate a glaciation. Now, once you've established a snow cover on the land, you actually then reinforce the initial cooling. Because, again, studies have shown that fresh snow reflects sunlight back to space far more effectively than bare ground. So, if you've initiated a snow cover, it then actually helps to reinforce the lowering of temperatures that you already have. Now, when the snow becomes old or it becomes slushy, it's less effective at doing that. But in fact, because the snowfall was so high at this time, because there was so much moisture being pumped into the atmosphere, the rates of snowfall were probably so high that actually the surface of the snow was kept pretty fresh anyway. Another factor that would have promoted this cooling effect would have been the cloudiness of the skies. If you pump all of this moisture into the atmosphere, you obviously generate lots and lots of clouds. And one of the things that a meteorologist will tell you is that if you have an area where there's regional cloudiness, surface temperatures drop. I mean, we know that, don't we? On a cloudy day, the temperature will be lower. So all of these factors, the volcanic cooling, the reinforcement of the snow that's already fallen, the cloudiness of the skies, all of these things cause a dramatic drop in temperatures across the northern hemisphere continents. So can you see that by simply going through the logical consequences of what must have happened after Noah's flood, we can see that we actually have the very combination of circumstances that we need to generate an ice age. We have the warm oceans producing evaporation, pumping moisture into the atmosphere. So we have higher rates of precipitation, which eventually falls as snow because the continents become very cold because of the volcanic activity that's going on, and so on, and because of the cloudiness of the skies. And then that gets reinforced when you have the snow on the ground. So here, after Noah's flood, we have just the combination of things that you need to explain the ice age. So what conventional scientists, with their uniformitarian principle, have found so difficult to explain, the Bible gives us a key to understanding. Now this is Michael Ord, who is a meteorologist who used to work for the US National Weather Service. And Mike Ord is probably the scientist who's done the most work to develop this model, this scientific theory of a rapid ice age after Noah's flood. And he published it, first of all, in one sort of form. He'd written a number of papers before this, but he brought it all together in a monograph in 1990 called An Ice Age Caused by the Genesis Flood. And one of the things that he shows in this monograph is that because you've got warm oceans and cold continents, you have a very strong temperature contrast along the coastlines. Okay? So you have this very strong contrast between cold continents, warm oceans. And as a meteorologist, he was able to model what would be the consequences of having such a strong contrast. And he found that what would happen, the natural outcome, would be storm after storm that would develop, particularly along the eastern coastlines of Asia and North America. And he calls the result a snow blitz. He said that as a consequence of this temperature contrast, snow would fall, it would be dumped in massive amounts very quickly, the ice sheets would begin to build up very rapidly and simultaneously across very large areas. In the conventional ice age theory, most scientists envisage the ice starting in small areas in the north and then gradually growing and expanding further south. But Mike Ord's model predicts that you actually get a much wider distribution of ice right from the start. The ice sheets just begin to build up simultaneously across rather large areas. And here are just a couple of his maps showing the major and the minor storm tracks that he predicts from this ice age model. The major storm tracks are these solid arrows, the minor ones are the dotted arrows, and these shaded areas are where the ice begins to build up. Favourable areas for the early development of the ice sheets were Canada, the northeastern United States, and East Antarctica. Some of the mountains in other parts of the world, Scandinavia, Greenland, West Antarctica, Western North America, they would have had mountain glaciers perhaps at this stage, but the ice sheets would first have begun to build up in this shaded area here. Many areas that were close to or surrounded by warm ocean early on were actually too warm for ice to begin to build up. They were kind of insulated by the surrounding or nearby oceans. And this would have included Britain and parts of the lowlands of Northern Europe. But so in those regions, the glaciation would actually have been initiated slightly later. But even in those areas, as the temperature of the oceans dropped, as evaporation cooled the oceans, you would begin to get ice building up even in those areas. And so here again, you see a bit later on, in the ice age, you see these major and minor storm tracks and the areas that he envisages being covered with ice. These areas here that are shaded a slightly paler colour, these are where you would have the thickest ice in kind of ice domes. So there would have been a few peaks, if you like, that were particularly where the ice was particularly thick. One of the most surprising conclusions from Mike Ord's work is how rapidly an ice age could have developed under the kind of conditions that we've been talking about. Assuming that the ocean temperature immediately after the flood was about 30 degrees centigrade, he calculated, depending on the supply of moisture, he calculated it would take somewhere between 174 years and 1,765 years to reach the peak of glaciation. His best estimate, his best guess, kind of falls between the two extremes. He thinks the best guess that he is kind of willing to go with is about 500 years. So he thinks that by about 500 years, you would get to the peak of glaciation. Now that is very short compared with conventional estimates, conventional reconstructions of the Ice Age. Most conventional scientists think of ice ages happening over tens of thousands of years. But in fact, there's no requirement, there's no necessity for those kinds of time periods. They're actually derived from uniformitarian kind of thinking, but then when you actually work out the calculations of the supply of moisture and the temperature of the oceans and so on, actually ice ages can be initiated much faster than that. And in fact, he estimated that if you lower the initial temperature of the oceans to maybe 25, 20 degrees centigrade, the time to maximum glaciation actually gets shorter. So you reduce the time it takes to get to the peak. So here we have a peak of the ice age at about 500 years. How thick would the ice sheets have been after 500 years of glaciation? Well, that partly depends on the amount of moisture that's available and how much of that moisture that's available in the atmosphere actually gets dropped on the ice sheets. There were two sources of moisture. There was the immediately adjacent oceans that were pumping moisture into the atmosphere, and there would also have been water vapour transported up into the northern hemisphere, up into the north from lower latitudes. Based on his estimates of available moisture, Mike Ord has proposed that on average the ice was about 700 metres thick in the northern hemisphere and a bit thicker than that, about 1,200 metres thick in the southern hemisphere ice sheets. Now again, there's a contrast here with the conventional theory of the ice age. The conventional ice age theory assumes that, again, that principle, the present, is the key to understanding the past. We have very thick ice sheets in Antarctica and Greenland today. So they assume that over a long ice age that takes, you know, tens of thousands of years, the ice sheets would build up to at least the thickness of the current ice sheets in Antarctica and Greenland. Those ice sheets are about 2,000 metres thick or thereabouts. So they usually assume that the ice sheets were thicker than in Mike Ord's post-flood model. However, there is an accumulating amount of evidence today that the ice sheet, particularly the ice sheet in North America, was not as thick as 2,000 metres, that it was actually relatively thin. And we even have some parts of North America that we know were surrounded by ice and yet themselves were not glaciated. They were free of ice. And that's very hard to explain if you have very thick ice sheets. But if you have a very thin, more patchy ice sheet, then we can begin to explain some of that evidence. It's also very significant that this post-flood theory that I'm talking about is the only ice age theory that has been able to explain successfully why ice developed in the places where we know there was ice. Now, you'd think that was a very significant test for a theory of the ice age, and it is. Consider, for example, this area here, which is in just northwest of Hudson Bay. I don't know exactly how you pronounce it. I guess it's Keewatin. It's in Canada. And we know from the evidence, the geological evidence, that there was, over that area, a thick ice dome during the Ice Age. So we know that there was ice centred on that particular area. Now, that area today is very cold. It would be cold enough to support an ice sheet. But there isn't an ice sheet there today for the simple reason that it's not wet enough. It's too dry. It's not enough moisture. And the reason that there's not enough moisture is because the nearby Arctic Ocean, which would be the obvious source of the moisture, what do we know about the Arctic Ocean? It's very cold, and it's covered with sea ice today. So there's not a lot of evaporation of ocean water from the Arctic. So we don't get much moisture in the atmosphere. So this area here today is actually quite dry. So this is a real problem. Many scientists have puzzled over this. How on earth during the Ice Age can you develop a thick ice dome over this area? Because according to this, again, this idea of uniformitarianism, the present is the key to the past, they think that the Arctic Ocean has been covered with sea ice. It's been very cold for a very long time. So it's very difficult for them to think, where can we get the moisture from to form the ice here during the ice age? However, the flood, the post-flood model has the solution, because what have we said about the oceans immediately after the flood? They were warm. So immediately after Noah's flood, the Arctic Ocean was not covered in sea ice. It was relatively warm. So, of course, there would have been an abundant supply of moisture from the Arctic Ocean to generate the ice. And so this model is the only one that is around at the moment that can explain why we get ice in the Ice Age in that particular area. An ice-free Arctic Ocean also helps to explain another puzzle in the Ice Age theory, which is why the lowland areas in Siberia and in Alaska escaped glaciation virtually altogether. The mildness of the climate in these particular areas during the Ice Age has been a real problem for the conventional theory, because if the Arctic Ocean is cold, this area should have been cold enough for the development of ice. It should have been very cold, but actually we know it was rather warm. And it was warm enough to support a very large variety of quite large animals, mammoths and rhinos and reindeer and all kinds of other animals. And they must have had an abundant supply of food. They were able to live in large numbers quite comfortably in this area. That implies, of course, that it was relatively warm and wet. Now, in the post-flood model, we have a relatively warm Arctic Ocean right next to these lowlands in Alaska and Siberia. That would have helped to insulate this area. It would have helped to keep it nice and mild. If the Arctic Ocean was covered in sea ice, how did this area stay so warm? So we have some puzzles for the conventional model that this model helps to explain. The post-flood model also explains why and how the Ice Age came to an end. This diagram here shows the circulation of the ocean waters after the flood. What would have happened, for example, in the Atlantic, is that you would have had vertically rising ocean water here. The warmer water would have risen towards the surface. It would have, as it evaporated and lost, as moisture was lost, you would have had evaporative cooling. The water would have cooled down and it would then have begun to sink where you have the dotted lines. So you'd have had a circulation. For a while, as the surface layer of water cooled down and sank, it was replenished by warmer water from below. But eventually that process would have cooled the entire ocean throughout its depth. You would eventually have begun to cool the entire ocean down over time. And when the temperature of the ocean reached a level at which it could no longer sustain the kind of evaporation that could sustain the build-up of ice on the continents, you would have reached a kind of tipping point. And at that point, the ice would have started to melt. There would have been more melting than there was build-up of ice. And gradually, the ice sheets would have stopped growing and begun to decline. And also, as you get less evaporation going into the atmosphere, fewer clouds would have formed, more sunlight reaches the surface. Over time, we saw evidence that the volcanism was declining. And so eventually, you would have reached a point where the ice sheets would have begun to disappear. How long would it have taken for those ice sheets to disappear? Well, if we assume an estimated melting rate of about 10 metres of ice per year, that's not an extraordinarily high amount. In fact, it's basically the rate that's observed today in the melting zones of modern-day glaciers in Alaska and in Iceland and Norway. And so if we assume about 10 metres of ice per year, at that rate it would have taken somewhere between about 100 and 200 years for the ice sheets to completely disappear. And so the total time from the beginning of the Ice Age right to the end of the Ice Age with the disappearance of the ice sheets was probably no more than about 700 years in total. So relatively short, much shorter than we're used to thinking in conventional theory. And we have evidence, again, of the rapid melting of these ice sheets, because the rapid melting of the ice sheets was often associated with catastrophic flooding. You obviously generate lots of water, and that water has got to go somewhere, and we have evidence of the passage of these vast quantities of glacial meltwater. One of the best examples, best known examples, is this one. In eastern Washington, we have a series, a very broad network of deeply carved channels incised into the hard bedrock. And it's called the channeled scablands. And for a long time, this was a puzzle to geologists. How had the channeled scablands formed? And geologists today agree that the way it formed was by the catastrophic draining of a glacial lake. There was meltwater that had ponded up here behind these ice dams, and at some point these dams were breached, and a bit like the Grand Canyon was carved by the draining of lakes, this glacial lake carved through this area and literally in a day carved out the channeled scablands in North America. And evidence of similar glacial flooding has been found in many other parts of the world. In fact, you may have seen in the news just this year, back in July, scientists have now confirmed that Britain became separated from mainland Europe essentially in a single day, when a catastrophic ice age flood took place in what is now the English Channel. And the scientists have looked at sonar images of the floor of the English Channel, which show these deep scars, these deep channels, which were cut by a sudden and massive discharge of water from an ice-dammed lake. And so some of the headlines in the press were saying this was the day that Britain became an island. Again, evidence of the very rapid draining of melting of these ice sheets. Now, this changing climate, this very rapidly changing climate, must have been a source of great environmental stress for many of these large mammals that we associate with the Ice Age. Many of them became extinct at the end of the Ice Age, probably because of these very rapid changes, perhaps helped along in some cases by man's hunting activities. There have been a number of puzzles about the carcasses that we find of woolly mammoths and woolly rhinos in Siberia and Alaska, because they have a number of quite puzzling features. Some of these carcasses are found in a standing position. It's as if they've been preserved where they were standing when they died. Scientists have been able to study them. Often they're very well preserved carcasses, and there seems to be evidence that these animals died by suffocation. They were suffocated. And these carcasses, buried in a standing position, have then become entombed in permafrost. The ground is saturated with ice, and it's turned into what we call the permafrost. And many of these carcasses also have broken bones. Now, how can we explain all of this? Well, again, this is probably a consequence of the very rapid disappearance of the ice sheets. Because what we know happened south of the ice sheets is, as the atmosphere dried with the disappearance of the ice, very large dust storms developed parallel to the southern margin of the ice sheets. And we find very extensive layers now of wind-blown dust and sand, what we call loess, right across parts of North America, Central Europe, Siberia, Alaska, and in China. And what seems to have happened is that during these dust storms, sometimes the dust accumulated so rapidly that it literally buried animals where they were standing. They just got caught in a dust storm, and they were literally buried where they stood. And of course, one of the consequences of being caught in the dust storm was that these animals suffocated. That explains why there's evidence that that was how they died. And then the cold front, which was associated with the dust storm, caused a very rapid drop in temperatures in the area where they were buried, which eventually led to the development of permafrost in the sediment around these carcasses. And the way their bones have been broken, it appears that the breaking of the bones was a post-mortem feature. It happened after the animals had died. And what we know, again, in sediments where there's ice forming, is you get shifting of the sediments, and that would be sufficient to break the bones, particularly the limb bones of many of these animals. So again, we have evidence that these animals were buried rapidly and in somewhat catastrophic circumstances. Now, I mentioned earlier that I believe that, unlike the conventional Ice Age theory, there was only one major episode of glaciation. Perhaps someone has suggested we ought to refer to this as an ice advance rather than an ice age. Ice age carries the connotation of long periods of time. This was a much shorter event. Well, what is the evidence that there was really only one ice age rather than a whole series of ice ages? Well, just very briefly, let me give you just some of the evidence that Mike Ord and others have put together to argue for this. First of all, as we've already said, one ice age is inherently more probable than many. If it's difficult enough to get one ice age started, you only multiply the improbability if you have more and more ice ages. So we would think just statistically that it would be more likely to have just a single ice age. However, there's more evidence beyond just that probability. That we can look at the ice age sediment that's been laid down by the glaciers, and we find that most of it is local. Most of it has not been transported great distances. It has been transported, but much of it has not been transported far. Now, in the conventional ice age theory, we have numerous ice sheets, maybe up to 50 separate ice sheets. And with each successive ice sheet, it would be transporting sediment further and further south. But the fact is, when we look at the sediment, we find that most of it has not been transported all that far. That seems to be much more consistent with one very rapid ice age, where most of the ice grew pretty much in place, rather than a series of ice ages. Thirdly, even conventional geologists acknowledge that most of the glacial sediment they study is from what they call the last ice age. Now, again, we have to ask, where are all the deposits that were laid down by previous ice ages? If there were up to 50 ice ages, we would expect to find evidence of many previous ice ages. And actually, that evidence is very sparse. And we'll look at in a bit more detail, just very briefly, in a moment, of some of the evidence that they say does point to successive ice ages, but mostly that evidence is lacking. Fourthly, the thickness of the glacial sediment is actually not all that great. We know today, if you look at, for example, Glacier Bay in Alaska, that a layer of glacial sediment up to 5 meters thick can build up in about 200 years. We have modern observations that show that you can build up pretty substantial layers of glacial sediment, meters thick, in just a couple of hundred years. How thick, then, is the glacial sediment in the interior regions that have been multiply glaciated in the past, according to the conventional theory? Well, actually, it's not very thick. It's no more than perhaps 10 meters thick or something of that order. Now, again, that is consistent with a fairly short and single ice age rather than a multiplicity of ice ages over a long period. Fifthly, as I've already mentioned, some areas within the glaciated regions are actually free of ice altogether. For example, in this area of Wisconsin, there are some very obvious landforms which ought to have been affected by ice erosion and have been completely missed. The ice has just completely missed them. And yet we know that there was ice surrounding this area. Now, again, if you think about this, if you had a succession of up to 50 ice sheets passing down through North America, how did they all manage to miss this one area? Surely one of the ice sheets would have affected this area. Now, again, you know, if you just have one ice sheet that was only there for a few hundred years, you can explain how some areas got missed, particularly if the ice was not as thick as in the conventional theory. But in conventional terms, it's very hard to explain. And then finally, those extinctions of those ice age mammals. virtually all of the extinctions are associated with what conventional scientists regard as the last ice age. There are very, very few extinctions which they attribute to previous ice ages. Now again, here's the question. How on earth did all of these animals manage to survive a succession of up to 50 ice ages only to all perish in a mass extinction at the end of the last one? Again, that fits better with the idea that there was one single ice age. If you want more details on that, then there's lots of detail in Michael's monograph. However, in some places near the margins, near the edges of the former ice sheets, it is true that there are some places where there are stacked layers of glacial sediments with non-glacial sediments in between. And in the conventional theory, these are interpreted as evidence of multiple ice ages. Now, we do tend to find this evidence only around the margins of where the ice sheets were. We don't tend to find that kind of evidence in the interior of the ice sheets, but round the margins. And based on evidence from geological studies in the Alps, in the Alpine mountain region, it became conventional wisdom for many years. It used to be taught as a fact that there had been four separate ice ages based on these stacked layers of glacial sediments and on glacial terraces and so on river terraces and in valleys in the Alps. And it became conventional wisdom that there were these four glacial episodes. They were given names, and then there were these warmer interglacial episodes between them. And once they'd been identified in the Alps, everywhere scientists looked, in Northern Europe, in Britain, in North America, they found the same four glacial periods, but they gave them different names in different areas. Now, here we have a cautionary lesson for all scientists. It's very easy to find evidence to confirm what you already think. It's called the reinforcement syndrome. Okay, it's very easy. You go out and you look for what you expect to find, and lo and behold, you find it. But sometimes it turns out you were wrong. And in this case, the geologists were wrong. Because today, nobody believes that there were four ice ages. The evidence was misinterpreted. But isn't it interesting that when it was found in one area, geologists found confirming evidence in many other areas. And they were all wrong. And today, geologists have abandoned this kind of scheme, and they believe that there were now up to 50 ice ages, as I've already mentioned, over the last 2.6 million years. Okay, but we do have this puzzle. How then are we to explain these stacked layers of glacial sediments, if not by multiple ice ages? Well, there are various alternative ways to explain how you get stacked glacial sediments around the margins of ice sheets. One way is that when you look at a rapidly moving and advancing glacier, what often happens is you get shearing of the ice at the snout of the glacier, where sheets of ice slide one over top of another. And glacial sediments, till, can get caught up, entrained in the ice. And it forms multiple sheets of ice of glacial sediments. And of course, when the ice sheet then melts, what you end up with is a stacked series of glacial sediments near the snout of the glacier. So that's one way in which you can explain stacked sheets. Another thing that we need to recognise is that the ice sheets would have been advancing and retreating in parallel with the volcanic eruptions. Remember, the volcanic eruptions cause cooling, and we know that volcanic eruptions come in pulses. You get an eruption, then a lull, and then there'll be another eruption. And we know even today that glaciers will respond to that they'll advance and retreat in conjunction with the cooling that goes on. So if you have various pulses of volcanic activity after the flood, we would expect that the edges of those ice sheets will be oscillating back and forth over time scales of maybe a few years or even months, perhaps. Some of these glaciers can move pretty fast, even in a period of days, weeks, months. So you get oscillations of the ice sheets. And of course, what that does is it can form multiple sheets of glacial sediments, even interspersed with non-glacial sediments in between. So there are mechanisms to form these stacked sheets that mimic what we might expect from multiple ice sheets, but in fact are caused by just one single dynamic ice sheet. Now we're almost at the end, and I'm conscious that I've slightly overrun my time. Not all of the ice sheets melted at the end of the Ice Age. We know that the ice sheets in Greenland and Antarctica continued to grow. They were protected from melting partly by their location in the polar latitudes, also by the high altitude of the ice that's deposited in these regions. And I just want to say just briefly at the end, just one or two comments about the ice core evidence. You may have heard that scientists have drilled into these ice sheets, they've drilled cores, and they can bring up cores of ice from these ice sheets. They've been doing it since the 1960s, and it's often claimed that these cores have shown that these ice sheets are many tens of thousands of years old, perhaps even up to a quarter of a million years old. So these are very strong claims, and many people have said that this is evidence against the kind of rapid post-flood ice age that I've been talking about. However, I think many people have a mistaken impression of how ice cores are interpreted. Many people think that you can actually visually count layers of ice or snow as you go down those cores. They think that as you go down, you can actually visibly see layers. Well, that is true to some extent near the top of the ice sheets, near the top. You can visually distinguish some layers. However, as you go deeper in the ice sheet, you cannot any longer visually distinguish annual layers. Because what happens is the ice flows, it gets compressed. The weight of the ice and the length of time that it has, that it's been sitting there, causes the ice to spread out. So if you start off with a layer of ice like this, after a certain amount of time, it will be compressed vertically and it will spread out laterally. And eventually what happens is the ice gets squeezed so much that you can't actually distinguish annual layers, and there's remelting and refreezing and so on. So you can't do it visually. What you have to do is you have to make some assumptions about the thickness of ice that represents an annual layer. You have to assume, as you go down, you have to do some calculations based on your model of how the ice sheet has flowed to work out what thickness of ice represents an annual layer. And this is where we run into a problem, you see. Because if this ice sheet has been there for a very, very long period of time, there has been a long period of time for the ice to be compressed and to flow. And so someone who believes already that the ice sheets are very old thinks that a very, very thin layer of ice will represent an annual layer. However, if you only believe, as I do, that these ice sheets have been there for a relatively short length of time, from maybe only sort of 4,500 years ago, then there hasn't been the time for that extent of compression. So what it means is that a much thicker quantity of ice represents your annual layer. It's all dependent on your prior assumption about how long the ice sheet has been there. So what I'm saying is that your conclusion about how many layers there are in the ice sheet, how many annual layers, is crucially dependent on your prior assumption about how old the ice sheet is in the first place. Your conclusion is built in. Okay, so it's not an independent conclusion. And Larry Bardiman and others have done a lot of work looking at the ice cores, and they've been able to reinterpret the ice cores and show that they're quite compatible with the recent rapid ice age model that we've been considering this evening. Okay, let me very briefly sum up. The Genesis flood, the biblical account of the flood, uniquely, and I mean that, uniquely provides the conditions that are needed for an ice age. Colder summers in conjunction with higher snowfall. There is no other scientific model of the ice age that has yet been able to explain how you get an ice age started in this way. The ice age was rapid. It did not take long periods of time. That is not necessary to explain the ice age. In fact, the ice age was more than likely 700 years from beginning to end, at the outside. It was probably much shorter even than that. There was only one ice age. The evidence confirms not a multiplicity of ice ages. It seems to be more consistent with a single ice age. And the bottom line, I suppose, the kind of take-home message is this. Many people dismiss the Bible. They say that the Bible is just a collection of religious stories, that it has no connection with reality. But in fact, I believe, as this model shows, if we take the Bible seriously as a book of history, if we accept that it's giving us genuine information about what has happened in the history of the earth, it gives us information, clues, that can help us solve even the most difficult mysteries concerning the earth's past. Thank you very much.